When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Last fall, Politico reporter Alex Thompson wrote a short news story about President Biden's then science advisor, Eric Lander.
And it was about how Eric Lander was driving everyone in the White House crazy.
He was changing deals, going up to Capitol Hill on his own, the kind of internal fighting that's not unheard of in official Washington. But then, after writing that article, Alex got a tip.
Then I received an anonymous email from a Proton Mail account that said I was missing the real story. The real story is how he treats his subordinates, how he treats his staff.
Lander, according to Alex's sources, was verbally abusing his staff, including a lawyer named Rachel Wallace.
She was the general counsel at the White House Science Office for Joe Biden. And she alleged that Dr. Lander bullied her and retaliated against her after she repeatedly raised ethical red flags about his behavior.
One of those red flags was about Eric Lander's closeness with another Eric, former Google CEO Eric Schmidt, and Lander's desire for Schmidt's foundation to help fund the White House Science Office. Schmidt and Eric Lander go back years.
Eric Schmidt and Eric Lander are incredibly close. Since 2012, Eric Schmidt has been on the board of the Broad Institute, where Eric Lander was the founding director. They both served together on the president's science council during the Obama administration. They were on the Defense Innovation Board at the Pentagon. So these two people are very close.
After Alex wrote about the bullying allegations, Eric Lander resigned from the administration under pressure. But Eric Schmidt's influence remains. According to Alex, at least two staff members from the White House Office of Science and Technology Policy were paid indirectly through Eric Schmidt's foundation. Roughly a dozen staffers in the 150-person office were associates of Schmidt's. Today on the show, the murky web between Eric Schmidt and the White House Science Office. A messy story about influence, ethics, and who gets to make policy. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and you're listening to What Next TBD, a show about technology, power, and how the future will be determined. Stick around.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
I want to go back a little bit and sort of set the table on Eric Schmidt's interest in democratic politics and policy. How far back does his involvement in White House policy go?
His interest in White House politics and forming relationships with the White House goes all the way back to the Clinton administration, in which the Clinton administration creates their first White House website, whitehouse.gov. And Eric Schmidt, as a high executive at then Sun Microsystems, comes in and helps them with that. Now, that's just a little bit of a taste. Starting with the Obama administration, really the 2008 campaign, Eric Schmidt is basically all over it, to the point that in October of 2008, while he's the CEO of Google, he goes on the campaign trail for Barack Obama. And then over the course of the Obama administration, there was an analysis done that basically found that a member of Google had basically met with White House personnel on average of once a week for the first 7 years of the Obama administration. During the 2012 campaign, Eric Schmidt was very involved with Obama's reelection effort, to the point that on election night, he was in the campaign boiler room. He also helped out of that experience, helped found a data company called Civis Analytics that helps Democratic campaigns, including Joe Biden's 2020 primary campaign.
What does he want? Is it just to be close to power? Is it to get a policy outcome that is favorable for his companies, or is it something more nebulous?
It really depends who you ask. Now, there are two main, I think, most compelling arguments. There are some people that obviously believe he's doing this because he's corrupt, that, even though he's worth about $23 billion, him having a role or sort of influence or a stake, a voice in science policy is a way for him to further enrich himself. I mean, he is on the board of a lot of artificial intelligence companies. He still has a lot of Google stock. He has a 20% stake in this huge hedge fund with over $60 billion in assets. So there's one side that's like, he wants to be close to power and he wants to further enrich himself. The people that are probably more sympathetic say that Eric Schmidt has a very strong belief that the future of American supremacy is based largely around the future of artificial intelligence policy. Essentially, Eric Schmidt has the conviction that whichever country is the most dominant in artificial intelligence policy is going to win the 21st century. And so he wants to have a very strong role in the future of American science policy because he believes it's necessary for the country.
Are there concrete ways that he has affected government science and tech policy that we can point to?
During the Trump administration, he ended up serving as chair of this Congress-created commission called the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence. And basically, them and a big staff, their job was to help set priorities for artificial intelligence in national security. It's supposed to essentially be something of a North Star for the Pentagon and for this defense establishment. And he was the chair of it. And they produced this huge 700-something page report that was released last year and is now, in some ways, sort of the map forward for how the defense establishment especially, but, a lot of the country is thinking about the future of artificial intelligence policy.
Where Schmidt comes together with the Office of Science and Technology Policy is kind of complicated. So what does OSTP do in its most simple iteration?
It is the science office within the White House. Now, you have departments. You have the health department. You have other places that deal with health. But OSTP is located within the executive office of the president. So in some ways, it is the science office with the most proximity to the president. Now, the priorities of the office, which was created in 1976, differs with every president. Now, in this current office, the Biden administration office, they've been tasked with planning for future pandemics, artificial intelligence policy writ large, especially how to think about civil rights and algorithmic discrimination. And they are now also in charge of Biden's cancer moonshot, which is one of his most personal priorities, and with dealing with climate change writ large.
So these are big issues.
Yes. And, they don't necessarily have the staff that, places like the Environmental Protection Agency do, or like the Pentagon does with artificial intelligence, but they are sort of the ones that set a lot of the parameters of how the White House is setting the direction with science policy.
President Biden pledged that he was going to make science a focus of his administration, and he elevated the Office of Science and Technology Policy, otherwise known as OSTP, to a cabinet-level office. Within that office, Alex says, lots of staffers had links to Eric Schmidt or his foundation, Schmidt Futures.
We already know that over a dozen associates of his, including current and former employees, landed at the science office, which is only about 150 people. He has close relationships with, obviously, Eric Lander. Several of the people that worked on the National Security Commission on Artificial Intelligence that he chaired also landed at OSTP. Former Google employees landed at OSTP. And also, over the summer, for about 4 months, the chief innovations officer at Schmidt Futures, a man named Tom Khalil, who had worked at OSTP in the past, was brought on to OSTP as an unpaid consultant while he was still being paid and working full-time at Schmidt Futures. Schmidt Futures is also very involved in many of the events and many of the initiatives that OSTP is doing. So, you know, on a personal level, he has very strong opinions of the future of science policy, and the number of Schmidt Futures connections and people that recently worked for Schmidt Futures is pretty significant, considering the office is relatively small.
Listening to Alex detail all of this can be a little confusing. Maybe the links between Eric Schmidt and OSTP feel slightly opaque. Alex contends that that's on purpose.
The thing is that it's supposed to be complicated, that these sort of relationships and dynamics are supposed to be difficult to unravel. I mean, that's how it's intentionally dense.
What do you mean by that?
It is not meant to be easily traced back to Eric Schmidt, is my point, is that there are some of these financial connections and connections to other people are meant to sort of be like one person removed. For example, this Federation of American Scientists Fellowship. Now, when these fellows are then sent to OSTP, they say that they're coming in as a fellow for the Federation of American Scientists. But I received internal emails that show that when they were trying to bring on a specific person, his name is Mark Aidenoff, who's now the chief of staff, internally, the deputy chief of staff of workforce put in writing, oh, the Energy Department has now secured Schmidt Futures funding for this fellow. So even though it was through FAS, there was sort of an understanding that, yes, they're coming through FAS, but this is a Schmidt Futures funded person.
I think people might listen to this and say, well, shared backgrounds and connections and advice are one thing, but that the money somehow feels different. When you talk to people within the science office, what was it that stuck out to them? Was it the funding or was it the kind of relationships that went way back?
The funding is what raised the first red flags. In the words of Rachel Wallace, it raised significant, quote unquote, significant ethical concerns. In particular, when they wrote in that email that they had secured Schmidt Futures funding for this person, in that email, they also noted that they had looped in Tom Khalil, who was still working at Schmidt Futures, about them bringing it all on. So Rachel Wallace said like her urgent and immediate advice is like, you need to get Tom Khalil away from anything dealing with Schmidt Futures funding of staff. And also Schmidt Futures and Eric Schmidt himself have significant conflicts of interest with what OSTP's work is.
What was happening in the office of OSTP while these ethical concerns were being raised?
You know, the ethics officials in the office sort of felt like they were playing whack-a-mole, where it's like a Schmidt Futures thing comes up here, they have to smash it down. Another Schmidt Futures thing comes over here, they have to smash it down. And they had to repeatedly tell people, hey, Schmidt Futures and Eric Schmidt have significant financial overlap and financial interests in the work that OSTP does. You have to withdraw from this fellowship. Like, Tom Khalil cannot be involved and helping bringing on Schmidt Futures backed personnel. There was this repeated sort of back and forth and tension between the ethics officials and some of the higher ups at OSTP. Now, to their credit, you know, sometimes they listen. You know, for example, the then chief staff of the office pushed Tom Khalil out. I think both sides probably feel like they're the good guys. if you're sort of these higher ups, you're like, we have to do so many things at this office and we need to get it done and we need these people. You know, this philanthropy is willing to help bring on extra hands while we're doing really important work. The ethics officials are like, yes, but they have their own interests and there is a clear conflict of interest here. Now, I talked to Norm Eisen, who was the quote unquote ethics czar during the Obama administration. And his opinion was that, like, hey, some of these are, you know, very meritorious concerns. That was his word. But he said, like, you can understand how a philanthropy would be like, we just want to help. And then people within the government are saying, yes, but government policy should be determined by the government. So in some ways, both sides felt that they were doing the right thing. But you can see how that would lead to conflict between people trying to keep the science office above reproach and then the people at the top just trying to, you know, deal with the fire hose of all the work. This is sort of where the tension came in.
After the break, why the science office was getting outside money to begin with.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci. This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queen say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket. So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
It seems pretty strange that a private foundation would be paying for public servants to work in the White House. But I guess I learned from your reporting that's not completely unusual in this office.
People in the office would say that it's chronically underfunded. They only have an annual budget of about $5 million. And
that's peanuts in Washington.
Yeah. Even the founding statute said that they should utilize consultants. And as a result, you know, people from Federation of American Scientists, from universities, send fellows to OSCP to sort of supplement the work. What's raised ethical flags is that it seems Schmidt Futures was using this mechanism that I think was very earnestly created to help supplement the work of places that are underfunded and understaffed, and using it to get his foot in the door.
It's such a murky set of issues because, as you've laid out, it sounds really problematic, but then it also sounds like almost in the charter of the office that it was set up to be problematic.
Yes. I mean, again, it was a mechanism sort of created with scotch tape. But what's happened is, and what the ethics officials internally flagged, is that they felt that Schmidt Futures was using this mechanism in an untoward way.
The White House told Alex that there was nothing unusual about its ties to Schmidt and that the ethical issues that were raised were properly handled. In a statement after Alex's story came out, Eric Schmidt's foundation said that it had worked with the science office for years to address funding issues and that there was no undue influence on policy. Do you see this as a story about the Biden administration or one about Eric Schmidt and his desire to influence policy?
I think it's much more the latter, but I think it's striking that even as the politics around some of these tech titans have changed a lot in the last 6 years. I mean, people forget, like, during the Obama administration, you know, Eric Schmidt's influence didn't raise any eyebrows because tech was
no,
cool.
No, everybody was like, ooh, Google's coming to the White House.
That's right. That's right. It was a cool thing. So as the politics have changed, Eric Schmidt's influence within Democratic administrations has not. I think what makes this story distinct is that this is a guy with a clear ideology about the future of science policy in America, both on the Pentagon and, you know, from the White House's perspective. And so it's beyond just him having influence. The way in which he has endeared himself to powerful Democrats over the last 15 years is distinct from the normal rich person. I think, like, you know, normal rich people have lots of friends in politics and stuff, but Eric Schmidt has taken a keen interest in solidifying his relationships with the most powerful Democrats in America for the last 12 years.
Alex Thompson, thank you so much for your reporting and for talking with me.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. This was fun.
Alex Thompson reports on the White House for Politico. That is it for the show today. TBD is produced by Ethan Brooks. We're edited by Tori Bosch. Alicia Montgomery is the executive producer for Slate Podcasts. TBD is part of the larger What Next family, and we're also part of Future Tense, a partnership of Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. I want to take a moment to recommend that you listen to Tuesday's episode of What Next, because you get to hear some Dua Lipa and learn about copyright law at the same time. We will be back on Sunday with another episode. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Coming soon from Slate Podcasts.
So, first it was Dade County.
Voters in the Miami area repealed civil rights for gay people by a 2-to-1 margin.
In the late 1970s, cities around the country began rolling back anti-discrimination laws that protected gay people.
And then it was Wichita, St. Paul, Eugene.
Successful campaigns against the gay community, which shocked us all.
A state senator from California watched the laws fall and saw an opportunity.
Homosexuality is a most repulsive lifestyle.
His name was John Briggs, and he wanted to deliver the anti-gay movement its biggest prize yet.
California realized that they were coming for us.
I'm Christina Cotterucci.
This season on Slow Burn, we'll explore how a nationwide backlash against gays and lesbians led to a massive showdown in California.
Now it's something called Proposition 6, the Briggs Initiative.
It would call for firing any teachers in California who practice homosexuality.
Your life as you knew it would be destroyed.
We've got to fight back. We can't let this happen in California.
The Briggs Initiative would be the first statewide vote on gay rights.
Gay rights now! Gay rights!
With so much at stake, young people became activists.
We were all coming out all day long, every day.
And activists became leaders.
My name is Harvey Milk, and I'm here to recruit you.
Slow Burn, Season 9, Gays Against Briggs. Out May 22nd, wherever you listen.
If we lose here, it'll be 50 years before we ever get back up again.
Like the drag queens say, take out the earrings, sharpen the nails, there ain't no going back.